From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the politics of outing, we talk with writer Michael Signorelli about why he has revealed the homosexuality of public figures against their will. He's the author of the new book, Queer in America, Sex, the Media, and the Closets of Power. Also today, the classic jazz of pianist Butch Thompson. For over a decade, he was the pianist with the Prairie Home Companion. Now he has a collection of recordings featuring the music of Fats Waller, Jelly Roll Morton, Scott Joplin, and others. And Gail Pemberton reviews Black Women in White America, a collection of writing by black women from the early 1800s to the present. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton took his sales pitch for his economic plan to the Los Angeles area today. He visited a job training facility in Van Nuys and took a trip to South Central Los Angeles. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton has been traveling through California this week, telling voters here what his budget plan will do for them. Yesterday, he promoted his defense conversion programs, designed to help communities and workers dislocated by defense cutbacks. Today, he underlined the need to both cut the deficit and spend more money on education and training programs, like the one at Los Angeles Valley College in Van Nuys, where he spoke with students this afternoon.
You really are on the cutting edge of that change. So I wanted to come here to try to illustrate that and to ask you as citizens to support my economic program, to support our efforts to bring the deficit down, to cut spending, to ask wealthy people to pay their fair share, to give people incentives for new jobs, and to invest more in education, training, and technology.
Later today, the president travels to South Central Los Angeles, the site of last year's riots following the Rodney King verdict. In Van Nuys, I'm Mara Liasson.
European officials welcomed the Danish vote today, accepting the Maastricht Treaty on European Union. The vote reversed a referendum last summer that shook the European community and its exchange rate mechanism by narrowly rejecting the treaty. Some analysts complain that the EC gave Denmark too many concessions to win approval in the second referendum and said that other EC members may now insist on exemptions of their own. Among other things, the Danes have not committed themselves to take part in a common European currency or a common defense. The Russian foreign minister worked on his new peace initiative for Bosnia today. Andrei Kozyrev held talks in the Serbian capital, Belgrade, and in the Croatian port city of Split. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
On the same day that the Russians abandoned an attempt to organize a meeting on Bosnia at the United Nations, the Russian foreign minister tried to put the best spin on his talks with the Serbian leader, Slobodan Milosevic. Milosevic turned down the proposal to post monitors on the Serbian border with Bosnia. In a news conference today, Russians Kozyrov called on journalists to watch the borders instead. Yesterday, the Russian foreign minister said the first step of a Russian peace initiative in Bosnia was to post Russian troops on the Serbian border. Today, Kozyrov stressed that while the Serbian leader had turned him down, Milosevic renewed his promise that he was cutting off all war aid to the Bosnian Serbs. Meanwhile, the Bosnian Muslims and Croats appear to have agreed to a new ceasefire after 9 days of savage fighting in the city of Mostar. In Belgrade, this is Deborah Amos.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 5.5 points to close at 3,444. This is NPR. The Environmental Protection Agency announced tough new rules on hazardous waste incinerators today. EPA Administrator Carol Browner said the agency will close some incinerators and prevent others from starting up. The new policy will include permit controls that will effectively freeze the nation's hazardous waste burning capacity at the current level, 5 million tons, for the next 18 months. The new policy will not affect a controversial waste incinerator in East Liverpool, Ohio. That incinerator, built by Waste Technologies Industries, is under fire from a coalition of environmental groups led by Greenpeace. Greenpeace said today that Browner's announcement amounts to a blatant and unjustifiable exemption for the Ohio incinerator. Palestinian witnesses say Israeli troops shot and killed 4 Palestinians in the Gaza Strip today. The Israeli army confirmed 1 death. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
The incident occur during a memorial service for one of six members of the Islamic fundamentalist Hamas movement killed by Israeli troops earlier this month as they tried to flee to Egypt. The service was held in an orange grove in the town of Jabalia. Palestinians say Israeli border police and undercover troops surrounded the mourners and opened fire without provocation. Israeli military sources say soldiers opened fire on one man who was carrying a gun. It later became clear that the gun was made of plastic. Another Palestinian died of wounds he received earlier this week. The violence in Gaza comes after the most recent round of Middle East peace talks ended without concrete progress. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Federal bank regulators say that U.S. real estate markets have shown solid improvement during the past 3 months. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation said that commercial and residential real estate is recovering across most of the country, with the exception of California. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Michelangelo Signorelli writes, "There appears to be a brilliantly orchestrated massive conspiracy to keep all homosexuals locked in the closet." Signorelli has made it his mission to get some of those people out of the closet, whether they like it or not. He's revealed the homosexuality of people in politics, the military, and show business. He now writes for The Advocate and was the media coordinator of the AIDS activist group ACT UP. Signorelli has written a new book called Queer in America, Sex, the Media, and the Closets of Power. His articles outing public figures have stirred up debate within the media and within the gay community about when, if ever, it's appropriate to reveal someone's homosexuality without their consent. Signorelli first began outing people in a column he wrote for the now-defunct magazine Out Week.
I decided that I was going to write a column discussing the popular press as opposed to the elitist press like the New York Times and whatnot, which I thought too much of the gay community focused on. I wanted to discuss and analyze and deconstruct how the gossip press, People Magazine, gossip columns, television, you know, all of those shows on television that certainly discuss people's lives. I wanted to talk about how they treat homosexuals because I really feel that on some level more people's opinions in this country are formed by People Magazine than by the New York Times. And what I saw was that the media, the popular media, kept gay people invisible completely while telling us everything there is to know about heterosexual public figures, including information about their private lives that they would rather not see made public. We know every gynecological fact about every public figure who is heterosexual, and it is glorified and glamorized over again. But homosexuals are never discussed unless they've, quote-unquote, admitted it. In no other kind of journalism would we not write about facts about a person that perhaps are private if they have something to do with a news story. But in this instance, we have this solemn oath, so to speak, that we just don't bring it up. It's a taboo.
Let me get back to your impressions of, you know, the People Press. You think that they don't mention somebody's homosexuality unless they're out because this press finds it too disgusting. You know what I mean? It's just like unspeakable that you'd be gay, so you don't mention it. But maybe it's not mentioned because journalists know that somebody could lose their job if others knew that they were gay, or, you know, especially in the entertainment industry.
I think that's the sort of straight liberal line that we see coming out of the media, but I don't believe for a minute that the media in our country cares about preserving people's jobs. They report lots of things about people, whether it's Bill Clinton or George Bush, that certainly can affect their jobs. So I think that they use that as an excuse, but I think that it's really about a complete visceral reaction or just an uncomfortableness with homosexuality.
So what are your criteria for outing a person?
It's a very complex issue, and it's an issue that the media has tended to try to make very simplistic by calling it all McCarthyism and fascism and kind of melding it all together. There are activists who are outing people to politicize homosexuality in an even more stronger way. Certainly the people who held press conferences outing members of Congress or put posters up of celebrities, that's one aspect. And then there's, of course, the supermarket tabloids that are doing it just to make a profit. And then there are journalists like myself wanting to equalize the discussion of homosexuality and heterosexuality. For journalists, I feel the criteria should be only when it is pertinent to a story and only about public figures, people who've made a deal with the public that their lives are open for dissection by the media, and of course when it can be journalistically substantiated and verified.
Well, it's unclear to me when somebody has made that pact with the public that their lives are open for examination. I mean, if you're an actor or an actress, do you have that pact that just because you're going to be practicing your art, your life is an open book? I mean, I don't think that sounds fair.
Well, I think that...
And I'm somebody who interviews actors and actresses all the time, but I always feel that, you know, they should have the right to draw the line between what's public and what's private.
I think that... They don't draw the line. The media does it for them in this country. But beyond that, there's a larger issue in the gay community about what is private and whether or not being gay is private. Meryl Streep is a very private star. We don't know much about her private life, but we do know that she's heterosexual, and the media does not think about that as being something of an invasion of privacy to say someone is straight or to portray someone as heterosexual. And there's a growing sentiment in the gay community that being gay, sexual identity, is not an issue of privacy, just like being straight is not private, that what you do in your bedroom is, and that sexual acts are. But all too often, the media has tried to couch being gay as what you do in your bedroom. The rhetoric used all the time is, what you do in your bedroom is your own business. Well, true enough. But we're saying that just saying to someone is gay is not talking about their sex life. It's an issue of sexual identity. And I think
Can we just stop here a second? What you're saying sounds very naive to me, in the sense that you're not acknowledging the fact that for a lot of people there are consequences to acknowledging that you're gay. And this isn't to justify that there should be consequences, but in the real world, in a lot of professions, including parts of the entertainment industry, there are consequences. So there's a difference between saying you're straight and saying you're gay in the press.
Right, but it is not, I think, the media's job to regulate or decide what the consequences are and what is reportable and unreportable according to the consequences. There are consequences to reporting a lot of things about people beyond their sexuality. There are consequences to reporting, you know, all sorts of issues regarding people's lives, even right down to, you know, if you reported that a star had plastic surgery. I mean, you report it, though.
You got started in media through the gossip business, and I'm really interested in hearing a little bit about this. You write about it in your book. You got started working for basically like a PR company that would plant items in the gossip columns for its clients. And you talk about that you'd often have information that somebody was gay, you know, someone who was, you know, in Hollywood or whatever was gay, but it was considered part of your job to cover that up?
To beard them. That was the term that we actually used. You bearded people. And sometimes you match together a gay celebrity, a gay male celebrity and a lesbian celebrity. It wasn't uncommon to sort of have them dating each other or in the media, etc. Not only did the studio people know this, the publicists, everyone in the business who was promoting this, we knew it on our end as the column planters. We would plant items in the columns. But the gossip columnists themselves knew it. And the other interesting thing was that many of us were gay, from the gossip columnists to the publicists right down the line, and the studio people, too. And we were all closeted. So you had a lot of closeted people preserving the closet of other people in order to preserve their own closet. What I think I've been doing in the last couple of years is sort of breaking the logjam.
When did it start bothering you that you were helping people perpetuate a lie about their sexual orientation?
Well, when I was doing it, I didn't even consciously think about it. It was just what you did. It was one of those things that, as we see so many classic examples in our culture of people just doing what they think is right and they're supposed to be doing while they're actually involved in destroying themselves and other people. It wasn't until, years later, when the AIDS crisis became so prominent in my own life, when friends were dying, when I saw everyone on our scene still even trying to ignore AIDS, you know, running away from it. We were still trying to make like it wasn't going to affect us. Nobody would ever talk about it, etc. And I was getting more and more alarmed because friends were dying, and I just wound up at an ACT UP meeting in 1988. And I was immediately, just immediately politicized in an incredibly powerful way by this organization. They were honest, open, they had facts and figures, and they knew what was happening, and they were not in denial like the rest of us. And it was that process of getting involved with ACT UP and looking at the AIDS crisis in that way that suddenly made me see everything from sexism and racism and, you know, homophobia to this industry I was in the perspective suddenly that was, you know, clear. And I started to see what I had been doing, what I was involved in, that I was basically involved in cover-ups and creating a charade and showing America a pack of lies and a reflection of itself that wasn't true. And in that sense, helping to reinstitutionalize the closet to all those young people out there.
My guest is Michelangelo Signorelli, author of the new book, Queer in America. Back after this break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about outing. My guest is Michelangelo Signorelli.
You know what I'd like to do? I'd like to just talk with you about the gossip industry a bit more, because I think you offer a lot of interesting insights into what happens behind the scenes and how it works. Can you just explain for us how you would get items, how you would plant items in gossip columns?
Well, what we did as column planters was a little bit different from the average publicist. Most often, we represented movie companies, 20th Century Fox or Universal, Touchstone. We actually represented all of them, Columbia, Broadway producers, and some performers. They would have their regular publicists who would get them on talk shows or have articles, you know, placed about them, have magazines do feature stories, newspapers, etc. But we provided a service of only getting them in the columns because it's an art in and of itself, and columnists are reluctant to take things just from any PR hack. They take them from the column planters. And what we would do is, and why they did that was because we provided them with other valuable information. We would send them a couple of pages of items. Every other item was an item about one of our clients. And every item in between was a juicy piece of gossip from within the industry or in Washington or in New York or even from Europe. And it would be some juicy information about somebody, who they were dating or who they were going out with, or some project somebody was working on that was secret, or, you know, who they were seen with, or some sort of hot commodity. How we would get the juicy information would be by going out to a lot of parties and collecting information and meeting people. But most often it was from a lot of people who would call up and give us it in return for screening passes that we would give them. So it's all sort of a bartering system that has just a food chain right down. We would then give them screening passes or Broadway tickets. But the even better sources were this army of service people who worked at, you know, super, who worked at the stores like Bloomingdale's or Henri Bendel's or stores like that, or were, you know, concierges or worked as taxi drivers or florists or any of these professions where they were coming into contact with the rich and famous. Celebrities, for the most part, are stupid. They talk in front of all of these people and talk about what they're working on, everything from their business to their life or whatever. And these people would simply, you know, call us up from the hair salon or wherever it was they were working and tell us about it. They were also the most reliable sources because they had no political, financial, or any other agenda, and they you could always find them. They couldn't. They were always going to be there if they gave you something wrong. And believe me, when gossip gets wrong, it's a very strict and rigidly controlled industry. When gossip gets wrong, there's a big to do. The publicist, the agent, the studio head, everyone right down to the columnist throws a fit. So we had to be really meticulous.
Would you have special sources who you trusted, or could any taxi driver or any hairdresser call you up and tell you something?
No, these would be people who we had developed relationships with over a long period of time. And sometimes they would introduce us to new sources who we then could trust because they were recommended by another trustworthy person.
Since you got your start in journalism through gossip, I'm wondering if you think that affected your interest in outing in other ways, too. For instance, I mean, you were trading the kind of information a lot of journalists wouldn't report on because they think of it as gossip, like who was seen with who or who was rumored to be making a deal with such and such company or something. Do you know what I'm saying?
Right. I went to journalism school at Syracuse, and I certainly had gotten a background in journalism and knew the distinction between journalism and gossip and know the distinction between them. And while a lot of the information we were dealing in was gossip, a lot of it was the stuff and is the stuff that journalists do report in news stories when it is pertinent to a story. And when I discuss this particular issue, I don't discuss it. In fact, I'm against just discussing people as gay in terms of gossip. I think it trivializes it. I believe when it's pertinent to the story, it should be reported. You would report someone's, cancer, alcoholism, extramarital affair, as we've seen, when it is pertinent to a story. And I feel that homosexuality should be also. And we don't see that. We see a sort of, you know, a journalist will get to a certain point and then find out this information and say, well, it is pertinent, but I can't report that. That's just, you know, my editor would never allow it. They don't go to the editor and push for it. They just simply say, I can't do it. The entire media, as I discuss in the book for several chapters, basically went silent two years ago in 1991 when I had discussed a Pentagon official who was gay and the hypocrisy of that with regard to the Pentagon's anti-gay policy. Every reporter at the networks, in Washington, at many of the news organizations, was trying to do that story. And when they would go to the network presidents or people higher up in the agencies, it would be killed. Sometimes I thought it was because it was the Pentagon and less to do with outing. It was just after the Gulf War, and I think the networks didn't want to go against the Pentagon. But a lot of it was because of outing and because of issues of disclosure. The William Kennedy Smith case had just occurred, and the New York Times and NBC had just been rightfully bludgeoned for doing that. And I think that everyone was just so afraid of going near this. And so here was a major American scandal when the Pentagon was saying that the security risk argument was the top argument then, not the morale argument, that gays were a security risk. Here was the one of the top people in charge of information who was known to be gay by Dick Cheney and the president. I thought that was a story, and I thought it was a story, and so did a lot of people who helped me from NBC, from Knight Ritter. They all wound up helping me to do that story. In fact, I couldn't have done it without the mainstream press corps, but they weren't able to do it. And I think that that represents a real problem in journalism today.
Have you ever had second thoughts or doubts about somebody who you've outed?
No, I've never felt that I did the wrong thing in talking about someone. I always talked about people when it was pertinent to the story. I do sometimes feel that, I do feel bad sometimes for perhaps my tone was definitely strident back then at Outweek, and I was very angry. And so I sometimes felt bad for the way that the tactics themselves or the way that I would attack someone. But in terms of talking about people's sexuality, I firmly believe that I'm not invading their privacy. Most of the people, in fact, all of the people I have discussed, it becomes this question of, is it private? If they're if they're really closeted, I mean, if you just sit in a room and masturbate, that would be an invasion of privacy. I mean, because no one knows that that you're gay. But we're talking about people who are known to hundreds, perhaps thousands of people. They live in a gay environment. They have people in their life who are gay. They have lovers. They've had many lovers. They go to parties. They go out. They have a lot of gay friends. And they're asking all of those people to collude in this secret. And it becomes questionable as to whether this is private. You know, what is the difference between those thousands of people knowing and they must tell other people and they tell other people and they tell other people. And, you know, what's the difference between that and printing it in the paper?
You know, you're talking about how people collude with people who are in the closet to keep that a secret and all the, you know, the pressure it's putting on people to collude with the gay person keeping the secret. But I think for anybody in public life, there's probably this understanding that there's a lot of things in their life that they'd like to keep private and that the people around them kind of agree to try to respect each other's privacy and to keep certain things private. I mean, I'm
right.
sure that, that
and I mean,
there's a lot that enters into that category.
There are a lot of issues like that. But with this issue, you have the added element here of the people you're asking to keep this secret, not only don't feel that they should keep the secret, but many times they feel that they are doing the wrong thing by keeping the secret. Richard Moore, a philosopher from the University of Chicago, had written a book, Gay Ideas, Outing and Other Controversies. And he discussed how the person who is outing is living with dignity because that person is not involved in a lie that they have to perpetuate. If I feel that the closet is wrong and that it's wrong for someone to be in the closet, then I feel that when I'm keeping someone's secret, I'm doing something shameful too. So it sort of has a chain reaction in that way. And again, with homosexuality, as opposed to other secrets, you're talking about something in which there's an entire rich community and a culture and a group of people who are marching forward and who are coming out of the closet more and more, and where as they come out of the closet more, they're less likely to want to keep the closets of other people.
I guess what you've just said puts, you know, kind of emphasizes what it is that makes a lot of people very uncomfortable about outing, a sense that you have the kind of morally superior position because it makes you uncomfortable that some people are in the closet, that you have the moral right to open that closet door and announce that they're gay, no matter how uncomfortable it makes them, no matter whether that allows them to lose their job or not, no matter what reasons they have for being private, you have the kind of higher moral, you're on the higher moral ground here.
Well, I think, again, I discuss in the book quite a bit that there's a growing feeling that you're not invading their privacy or opening a door or whatever, that you are simply discussing the truth. And I mean, if that makes it, you know, something of you're on moral high ground, I think everyone who believes in the truth should be on the moral high ground here. I think that you're discussing what you feel is something that, you know, you're saying, I'm not going to be part of your secret. I think that in that sense, you know, it's the closeted person who's asking the rest of us to do a favor for him, is asking us to be part of this. And I if it means that you're being on the moral high ground simply by saying, no, I don't want to be involved in that, I don't want to be a part of your secret, then so be it. But I think that increasingly a lot of people feel that way. They feel that they don't want to be part of this conspiracy that I talk about.
Michelangelo Signorelli, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Michelangelo Signorelli is the author of the new book, Queer in America, Sex, the Media, and the Closets of Power. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Butch Thompson had to play a little bit of everything when he was pianist for Garrison Keillor's A Prairie Home Companion, opera, bluegrass, you name it. But his specialty was and is classic jazz, music by Jelly Roll Morton, Fats Waller, U.B. Blake, Scott Joplin. He has a series of recordings featuring their compositions. Coming up, Minnesotan Butch Thompson tells us how New Orleans changed his life. And Gail Pemberton reviews the book Black Women in White America, featuring essays by African-American women of the 19th and 20th centuries. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In testimony today on Capitol Hill concerning Bosnia, Secretary of State Warren Christopher dismissed a Russian proposal to implement the Vance Owen peace plan gradually, even though it's been overwhelmingly rejected by the Bosnian Serbs. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Secretary Christopher told the House Foreign Affairs Committee he was frankly surprised that the Russians would try to force the Vance Owen plan on the Bosnian Serbs.
The president has said, and I've said repeatedly, that we would not try to impose a settlement because that mires us down in the quagmire of Bosnia.
It was because of this disagreement with the Russians that Christopher rejected Moscow's call for a Security Council meeting this Friday to discuss Bosnia. He wanted to avoid a meeting where no consensus could be reached. Christopher will confer with the Russian foreign minister in Washington on Thursday and the French foreign minister on Monday, trying to agree on a workable approach to the problem. Christopher said Mr. Clinton still favors arming the Muslim-led government of Bosnia and launching airstrikes on its behalf if necessary. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Russia's foreign minister says he is still trying to organize a meeting of UN Security Council foreign ministers concerning Bosnia, despite the canceled meeting. The White House is holding firm against congressional Democrats who aim to strip the president's economic plan of its energy tax and place caps on mandatory spending programs such as Medicare and Medicaid. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Passage of the president's deficit reduction package relies solely on congressional Democrats. Republicans in both houses have made it clear they'll stand united against any new tax increase, even in the name of deficit reduction. But problems are occurring within Democratic ranks. Texas Democrat Charles Stenholm says he has enough conservative and moderate Democrats to amend the plan with caps on entitlement programs ranging from food stamps to Social Security. Vice President Al Gore rejected the proposal today during an appearance on Capitol Hill.
That cap, which is would be very arbitrary and potentially destructive to our economy, depending upon the course of the economy in years ahead, would be very bad for the country. We oppose it unequivocally and very strongly.
The vice president also flat-out rejected a proposal that's gaining momentum in the Senate to do away with the energy tax altogether. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
President Clinton says that while higher taxes are not popular, they are necessary because of huge deficits brought about by what he termed the GOP free lunch crowd. On a Western trip to sell his economic proposals, Mr. Clinton attacked budget policies during the 12 years of Republican leadership. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 5 points to close at 3,444.39. This is NPR News. Voters in Denmark have approved a plan for European unity. Nearly 4 million Danish voters were asked to approve a treaty to create a common European foreign policy, central bank, and currency by 1999. All 12 EC nations must approve the treaty for it to go into effect, and voters in Denmark turned it down once before. Now Britain is the only EC country not to approve the plan. While it appears that Britain will approve the treaty, it is not certain because of opposition in Parliament. The agreement is aimed at giving the EC more power in world affairs and make it more competitive against the United States and Japan. Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Carol Browner wants to clean up the hazardous waste incineration industry. She announced a temporary freeze today on incinerator permits and plans to review the licenses held by hundreds of facilities already operating. NPR's John Nielsen reports.
Over the next 18 months, EPA officials plan to take a second look at most of the country's hazardous waste incinerators, a wide range of facilities that together burn about 5 million tons of toxic waste every year. EPA Administrator Browner says it's the only way the agency can be sure that these incinerators do not pose a threat to public health. More than 100 incinerators holding temporary permits will be held to strict new air pollution standards that are now being developed, the agency said. Browner said it was likely that several operating incinerators would have their licenses pulled at the end of the review. Browner said this EPA review was not designed to kill the hazardous waste incineration industry, which expanded rapidly through most of the 80s, but she says she does plan to push businesses to find ways to produce less hazardous waste. In Washington, I'm John Nielsen.
In trading in Europe, the dollar moved up against other major foreign currencies. Gold prices also moved up. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Did you lose track of Butch Thompson after he left a Prairie Home Companion? He left the show in 1986, after 12 years as the show's pianist. Well, since then, he's been traveling around America and the world performing classic jazz. And he's made a series of recordings featuring the music of Jelly Roll Morton, Fats Waller, UB Blake, Bix Beiderbecke, and others. Before we talk, let's hear something from his latest CD, Minnesota Wonder. This is From Monday On. Of our listeners know you're playing from Prairie Home Companion. Do you think that your recordings show off a different aspect of your playing?
Yeah, a lot of the music on the Prairie Home Companion, of course, was a wide variety of styles and a wide variety, perhaps, and I'm talking only about myself here, but a wide variety of, competence or familiarity with whatever styles were being presented. I sometimes felt like I was playing things that I wasn't exactly completely the master of.
You know, I think, judging from your recordings, I'd have to say you're not a show-off. You don't go for speed or for the fancy stuff. You're in fact, a very reflective player of early jazz.
Yeah, I think there's a side of me that has probably emerged more recently. When I first started learning this stuff, you know, I was still a teenager. And at that time, I was much more interested in the flashy side of it, fast playing and, you know, quick left hand and impressing people with virtuosity or something. And as the years have gone by, I've got more and more concerned with lyricism, I think, and reflectiveness, as you say, which is a good word, so that nowadays I'm more likely to sit down. If I'm going to sit down and just play for relaxation, I'll probably play something pretty rather than something fast.
Well, speaking of reflective, you do a piece by Fats Waller called Chelsea that I think is much more reflective than the Fats Waller tunes most of us are familiar with. Tell us something about this piece, how you found it, why you play it.
Well, it's part of a suite that Fats put together, which was meant to portray different parts of the city of London. And actually, I think it reflects a side of Fats that he may have wanted to get out to the public more than he was actually in a position to do quite often. He was in fact an extremely lyrical and reflective player. It's a beautiful piece, extremely beautiful melody, and I I just thought it fit in nicely with the sort of tone I wanted to have on this recording.
Well, let's hear Chelsea by Fats Waller. This is Butch Thompson at the piano from his latest record, Minnesota Wonder. Butch Thompson is my guest. We're listening to a Fats Waller piece from his latest album, Minnesota Wonder. Let me ask you a couple of Prairie Home Companion type questions. How did you first get onto the show? How did you first become the house band?
Garrison Keillor and I were classmates, more or less, at the University of Minnesota. And we were in several classes together. It's back in the early 60s, and that's where we met. Later on, he started the show. Actually, I believe in 1974, he did some of the first radio broadcasts, which were similar to what the show would become. And I was asked to be a guest frequently after 1974 and took over sort of the house piano player job by a process of accretion or something, elimination, so that by the time it became a national program, I was the piano player and I had my trio there.
You know, during the show, one of your featured spots would be the intermission break, when everybody was supposed to get up and stretch their legs and talk amongst themselves.
That's right.
And the local announcer would come on the local radio stations and promo what was happening that evening on the station. How did you feel about taking your kind of showcase piece at the time when other people were supposed to talk?
Well, quite often we decided to practice something. Since we didn't think that many people were listening. Turned out later that they were, but we sometimes thought, well, nobody's going to hear this exactly. They'll know that somebody's playing, but why don't we rehearse this or that? It's hard to believe, I suppose, but it's true. I wasn't that upset about it, really. I found that the listeners were sometimes a lot more disturbed about it than I was.
My guest is pianist Butch Thompson. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is pianist Butch Thompson. He has a series of solo piano recordings distributed by Rounder Records. So tell me something about your early days taking piano lessons. Did you have good teachers? Did you choose them yourself? Did you want to stay home all the time and practice?
My mother found a teacher for me. I'm from a small town called Marin on St. Croix. It's on the St. Croix River here in Minnesota. She found a teacher. She talked a friend of hers into taking me on. This person had never taught piano before.
Oh, great.
but there wasn't anyone else in town who could even start to teach me at that time.
Huh. Was that because your town was so small or what?
Yes, it was a small town of 300 people.
Wow, that is small. And my apartment building had lots more people than that.
from there I went to an ex-concert pianist in a nearby town of Stillwater, a woman who actually taught me a lot just by her example. She'd sit down and play whatever it was we were working on in an extremely dramatic fashion. We played things like Clair de Lune and all the sort of standards of piano lesson literature. And she would play these dramatic version. She had a lot of flair, and that really showed me something, probably more than the technique that she tried to put across. It was this style. You have to have style.
What was the biggest drama surrounding your the first part of your life or the first part of your musical life?
I found actually my sort of conversion experience almost when I was in junior high school, in fact, in the seventh grade, and played in the junior high school talent show in Stillwater, Minnesota. This was the worst case of stage fright I think I've ever had. I've never been anywhere near as upset as that again. But the audience was the best audience in many ways that you could imagine, because what I did was play a version of Bill Haley's Rock Around the Clock as my piece in front of the junior high school audience. And they were knocked out. This was top 40 stuff. And I had known that they were going to find it unusual, and I thought they might like it, but I had no idea that they were going to have this kind of explosive reaction. And in some ways, maybe that's why I'm a professional musician, because of that experience. Could be. It really confirmed me, at least, in my ambition, which in fact, I don't remember a time when I didn't think that it would be a glamorous profession.
Well, how explosive was this reaction? Did they dance?
No, they just made a lot of noise when I finished the piece. I think part of it was probably that they were so surprised that I did something like that.
And yet you didn't become a rock and roll player.
No, I didn't. But the music of the 50s and the early rock and roll hits were actually not that different stylistically from some of the things I'd been interested in learning to play. Boogie Woogie, particularly, it was a kind of piano music which I was very interested in. And it was no trouble at all to adapt the music of Bill Haley and Elvis Presley and Little Richard and Fats Domino. Both Richard and Fats, of course, were piano players anyway, to this boogie-woogie style.
Now, what's another big drama that changed your life, another big turning point for you?
Well, a major turning point was my first encounter with the New Orleans musicians at Preservation Hall. I really can't emphasize enough how impressed I was with them and how amazed I was to run across musicians who played the way they did. They were so relaxed and so... I think I learned more by watching them at first than I did by actually listening to what they were playing, because their attitude about music was something different from anything I'd ever imagined. They took a lot of pride in what they were playing, but they were so relaxed. They weren't jumping around. They weren't pointing the clarinet at the ceiling. They were just sitting there and playing their music. It was a revelation to me. It really was.
Now, how old were you about when you met them?
18.
Uh-huh. So you,
impressionable.
Right. And just out of the small town that you grew up in.
That's right.
Now, I imagine that the small town you grew up in was predominantly, if not completely, white.
That's right.
And so you hadn't been exposed to many or maybe even any black people, let alone really good people from the jazz life, you know, who'd lived a life, rather long life, playing jazz. So, what was it like for you to actually start talking with them and playing with them? Were you nervous about introducing yourself, and did you feel, really different, like a real outsider?
Well, in fact, I think the whole thing was made even more of a culture shock by the fact that I was in New Orleans and that it was such a different place. It's almost like being in a foreign country, particularly if you haven't been much of anywhere else and you're from a small town in Minnesota. It's more like being in the tropics, and there are so many different cultures that kind of came together in New Orleans that it didn't occur to me really that the blackness of the musicians was any different from all the other cultural differences. I really never thought of it quite like that.
Did you worry at first that you would come off as hopelessly square?
I did have a feeling, and that is why you're nervous in a situation like that, because I didn't talk like they did. My accent, I'm extremely aware of my of my accent whenever I go anyplace, because I know that I have a Minnesota accent, but I knew I didn't exactly speak the same kind of English, and I felt very self-conscious about that, as you always do when you're a teenager.
As you were picking up new styles of playing, were you picking up new ways of speaking as well?
No, I never did that. I was too self-conscious, perhaps. So all I picked up was the music. It's one of the things that is perhaps attractive to someone of my background about the music is that it is such a free expression of emotion and such a natural outpouring of things that are perhaps not put into words that often or acted out in a very direct way by people from the kind of background that I'm from, which is predominantly Scandinavian and from Minnesota. We don't do that. We don't have emotional outpourings, but we do it in music, perhaps. And certainly the music of the blacks in New Orleans is a highly expressive kind of thing that was attractive to me.
Well, gosh, I have to say, you really sound like the kind of inhibited, shy Scandinavian Minnesotan that Garrison has always talked about in his monologues. and here you were learning a very uninhibited form of music.
Right. I'm sure that's what attracted me to it.
Mm-hmm.
That confrontation with, as a means of personal expression. I'm sure that's what attracted me to it.
Butch Thompson, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Butch Thompson's series of classic jazz recordings is distributed by Rounder Records. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, we have a piece from Elizabeth Arnold on some rebellious voices being raised in the House of Representatives by Democrats who have problems with the president's budget. There is some sense that perhaps the president's policies on gays in the military may come to some sort of compromise in the near future. We have a story on abortion restrictions, which are passed in the several states, an update on that from Kathy Lohr, and the new airport in Denver. It looks as though it may not be necessary to the nation's infrastructure to spend quite that much money. Noah Adams has a piece for us on the sanctions in Serbia and how they are biting.
Thanks, Linda. Then and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Black Women in White America was one of the groundbreaking texts in American history and African American and women's studies in the 1970s. It's an anthology of writings by black women, slave narratives, autobiographies, essays, letters, speeches, and eyewitness reports, dating from the mid-19th century to the 1970s. The collection was edited by historian Gerda Lerner and originally published in 1972. Now there's a new paperback edition. Critic Gail Pemberton has a review that begins with a reading.
The instructions are as follows. Never let the word dumb be used in your class or anything said disrespectful of parents or guardians who may have helped the child. Many a child called dull would advance rapidly under a patient, wise, and skillful teacher, and the teacher should be as conscientious in the endeavor to improve himself as he is to improve the child. And I'm always sorry to hear that such and such a person is going to school to be educated. This is a great mistake. If the person is to get the benefit of what we call education, he must educate himself under the direction of a teacher. These words of wisdom about education and teaching and children in life, which are quite timely now, were written by Fanny Jackson Coppin in 1912. Koppen was born in slavery and went on to graduate from Oberlin College. For 41 years, she was the head of the female department, as they called it then, at the Institute for Colored Youth in Philadelphia. Koppen's words are included in this anthology, which is an amazing testimony to black women. Women who, during and after slavery, endured constant indignities and worse to their bodies and souls. Women who fought literally to salvage their own lives and those of their families from the effects of racism and sexism. It's also a gross reminder that too little has changed. As Fannie Lou Hamer in 1971 said, "Traveling around, I found one thing for sure. It's up south and down south, and it's no different." What many of these women survived and what others witnessed are sometimes chillingly presented here. Readers of Toni Morrison's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel Beloved will find the true and appalling story of Margaret Garner, the slave woman who tried to kill her children rather than see them become slaves. Garner's story was the inspiration for Morrison's protagonist, Setha. Harriet Tubman was the woman they called Moses because of her 19 trips on the Underground Railroad leading escaped slaves northward. Echoing Nathan Hale, Tubman wrote, "There was one of two things I had a right to, liberty or death. If I could not have one, I would have the other, for no man should take me alive. I should fight for my liberty as long as my strength lasted, and when the time came for me to go, the Lord would let them take me." Tubman, who never lost a passenger on the railway, died at the age of 90 in 1913. We read about the lives and goals of 20th century women, like Mary McLeod Bethune in her begging letters, as she called them, fundraising for Bethune-Cookman College, and Daisy Bates, a tireless and legendary NAACP activist who movingly details agonies faced by the 9 black teenagers who integrated Central High School in Little Rock in 1962. Regardless of the century, the concerns of black women in white America are those we greet daily in newspapers, on radio, and television. We read of the persistence of racial prejudice and sexism, poverty, poor education and health care, physical and psychological abuse, and humiliation. Equally significant is that so many of the writers are resolved to persevere against injustices of all kind, to leave a better world for their children and a written record, a history, for those children to never forget. We might ask what the republication of an anthology, now 20 years old, can say to us. For one, it offers us an opportunity to recognize that race relations today, for better and worse, have their sources in the past, and if we are to change things for the better, we need to know that past well. Black Women in White America provides a good starting point for those eager to understand just how the dimensions of race and gender are at the core of American history.
Gail Pemberton is Associate Director of Afro-American Studies at Princeton University and author of The Hottest Water in Chicago, Notes of a Native Daughter. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein, research assistance from Penny Nelson. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Every day I have to cry. On the next Fresh Air, as promised, we bring Arthur Alexander back to the show to talk about his music and his life. And we'll compare his recordings of his songs with those made by the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Lord, I know that I'm just a poor man, but is it wrong to love? 'Cause I'm not a rich man, but you